Morning Hunterin' kicks off your day by providing you with local news, traffic, and weather, as well as light topics through Vitamin C, Wake Up Call, and Chamber Chat. I also have many guests focusing on Hunterin' County community, business, and education. Listen to me every weekday morning from 8 a.m. to 10 a.m. on Good Morning Hunterin', HunterinChamberRadio.com.
Lose 20 to 40 pounds in 40 days, guaranteed. Let me repeat, lose 20 to 40 pounds in 40 days, guaranteed. This is not a crazy diet or exercise program, no drugs, hormones, or shots. You can lose 20 to 45 pounds in 40 days with Nutrimos Resonant Frequency Technology to measure 2,800 of your body's key biomarkers. Using NRF, they can find and correct the cause of your weight problem by measuring factors affecting weight gain, including metabolism, fat burning, fat storage, appetite, detoxification, and hormonal regulation. It's safe, fast, easy, and effective, and you won't walk around hungry or have cravings. It's even doctor supervised. Schedule a body composition analysis and consultation. You can be transformed in 40 days guaranteed. This is a limited time offer, so they can't wait to see you look great.
So call 888-718-7077. That's 888-718-7077. Or visit njthin.com. That's njthin.com.
Good afternoon, Hunterin' Radio, Friday afternoon, 4 o'clock. I'm Pat Smits, your host. As people know, I'm an attorney here in Hunterin' County, but I have, I'm really lucky today to have two guests, and I'll introduce them in a moment after I tell you about the weather. Well, there's another slight chance of snow tonight, only about 20%, so we really probably not snowing in most of the areas. Tomorrow should be very nice, mostly sunny. High of about 55 degrees, can you believe? February and 55 degrees, so it should really be nice. Again, on Sunday, we should have a very nice day, mostly sunny, and then there is a slight chance of rain because, again, it's up in the 50s on Sunday. Again, Sunday night, about 50% chance of rain, slight chance of rain on Monday, and so basically we should have a really nice weekend. And let me now introduce my guests. I'm really pleased today to have both Marcus Rayner, who is the president of New Jersey Civil Justice Institute, and Emily. Now, Emily, tell me how to pronounce your name, because I don't want to mispronounce it.
Kelchin,
just like it sounds. And she is the director of public affairs for the New Jersey Civil Justice Institute. And I'm really pleased to have them here today because I think, as people know, this is a program about the law issues, and certainly this is a very important because they have a plan that to fix the problem that we have in New Jersey. And I think what I'd like to have them tell us about, maybe Marcus could start, and really, you were one of the founders or the founder of the Institute, so perhaps you could explain how this came about and not only the impetus, but some of the early beginnings and why your institute, the New Jersey Civil Justice Institute, is as important as it is in New Jersey.
Sure. Thanks, Pat. And I'm thrilled to be here and just say that Emily and I are both Hunterin' County residents, so we're close to home here, and it's nice to be part of your program. The New Jersey Civil Justice Institute, which I'm the founding president of, is an organization, I like to describe it as a chamber of commerce dedicated to one issue, which is legal reform and legal policy. We were founded by a number of employers here in the state of New Jersey who became alarmed in 2007-2008 about a mass flood of out-of-state plaintiffs coming into New Jersey to sue some of our pharmaceutical manufacturers down at the time it was down in Atlantic County. And since then, as we've looked deeper, we've identified a number of areas in the law where New Jersey is an outlier and where we're encouraging class action litigation by out-of-state plaintiffs into New Jersey. And we view this as an economic issue, something that chambers of commerce and businesses and employers should be concerned about, because litigation is a cost of doing business. If you're a large company, it can be a significant cost that you can absorb. But if you're a small business, it can literally put you out of business if you find yourself a victim of a lawsuit. Certainly, if you've done nothing wrong, it can be very troubling and alarming. But litigation is expensive, and we believe that our courts should be efficient and fair, treat plaintiffs and defendants equally based on the facts of the case, but that litigation shouldn't be unnecessarily costly and burdensome to anybody. If you have a dispute, you should be able to resolve it relatively quickly.
Well, certainly the case. And one of the things, I didn't talk much about your background, but why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and how it is that you got to the point where you worked and established the Civil Justice Institute?
Sure. I worked in government for many years. I worked for a member of Congress, Mike Ferguson, who actually represented Hunterdon County for some time. Now Leonard Lance, Congressman Lance, is his successor in that district. And prior to that, I worked for Governor Whitman, both in Trenton on her policy staff and at the EPA briefly when she was down there. And I've always believed that government has a very effective role to play at creating the right economic climate to allow businesses to grow. And often that includes getting out of the way, but certainly it includes creating the right laws and the right legal structure for businesses to operate in. And when I was approached with this opportunity, the companies that were involved, ranging from Johnson & Johnson and Bristol-Myers Squibb to the New Jersey Chamber of Commerce, these are kind of core businesses that make this state as economically successful as it is. And the fact that they were alarmed at this issue told me that it was important and told me that I'd like to be part of trying to convince government to make changes, positive changes.
Well, one of the things that I think people, perhaps you could just briefly talk about what class action suits are, because those of us who have gone to law school, and I'll talk to Emily in a few minutes, we have some sense of class actions, but I don't think that most people in, really do. I mean, maybe every once in a while they'll get something in the mail that says, if you sign this, or, if you, had this product or whatever, you might be entitled to some money. But I think most people recognize that, there's very, very little money that comes out to the ordinary plaintiff in those cases.
Class action, let me first say, class actions are not inherently bad. It's like any system. There are useful ways to use the class action system, and there are ways that it gets abused. But the class action system is a court-created device to pool many similarly harmed plaintiffs into a lawsuit where you have many, many people. And the way it's supposed to work is they're supposed to have similar injury and similar reason for their injury against a defendant, and then their cases all get combined together into one large case that gets handled. And, it started back in the day with environmental torts and things of that nature, and now it's expanded to everything. And I'm sure your listeners are familiar with what we call the coupon suits, which, if you've ever bought a product, you can be part of the class, and sometimes you get a coupon for a discount on a future purchase or something. We're concerned that the class action system in this country generally, and in this state particularly, has evolved into kind of a gotcha game, where there's an incentivized structure for attorneys, because they usually get their fees paid for, to go after companies for labeling issues, misrepresentations that really aren't necessarily harmful to the customer. And the resolution of that is usually not a benefit to the consumer, but the attorneys walk away with a hefty paycheck, and the company really doesn't have to change behavior. The best example of that, just to give your listeners a specific example, was a Subway suit against the Subway sandwich franchise in 2014. You've probably heard the jingle, $5 footlongs. Well, Subway for a long time advertised $5 right, to get a footlong sandwich. Well, some enterprising attorney went out there and found out that, in fact, if you measure 100 footlong sandwiches, you're going to find some are 11 and a half inches, because bread doesn't always rise the same way. And they brought a class action lawsuit with several named plaintiffs that alleged that everyone who'd ever bought a Subway sandwich in New Jersey and nationwide should be compensated. Well, the end result of that was Subway admitted no wrongdoing, made a basic promise to try to do better. The attorneys walked away with $500,000 paycheck. The several named plaintiffs got $1,000 each, and the rest of Subway's customers got nothing. Interestingly enough, just this year, Subway announced that the $5 footlong is now $6. I don't know if it's because of the lawsuit, but certainly it made making those sandwiches more expensive for Subway, and I'm not sure the customer got a good benefit out of that.
Well, you know, and you're right. There were in the past, the only way certain plaintiffs would ever get compensated would be in some kind of a class action, because no attorney would take on an individual plaintiff. But I think it has, in my view, and, you know, I am an attorney, but in my view, these suits really give attorneys very bad names. There are very few of them that are, or there are few firms, and they're advertising on television, and you're right. So let me go back a little bit. Emily, how is it that you became affiliated with the New Jersey Civil Justice Institute? And give us a little bit about your background.
Sure. Thanks, Pat. I started getting interested in the law and lawsuits when I was growing up. My parents owned their own business and also owned a farm. And they owned the business as a sole proprietorship. And then a lawyer told them, you know, you really need to fix this and put it in an LLC, or you could lose your farm and everything you've worked for. And that was kind of my first introduction into the law and kind of thinking about it from that perspective. So I ended up going to law school in Wisconsin, and then I worked as a lobbyist in Wisconsin for civil justice reform there, and we were successful there in passing several initiatives. And then I moved to New Jersey a couple years ago, and Marcus had an opening and asked if I would join the team, and I've been working here ever since.
Great. And basically, tell me a little bit about your role.
My role is the Director of Public Affairs. So that means I do a lot of the background research on particular issues, but then also figuring out how to best communicate it. Like, a lot of the topics we talk about are really complex legal issues, and unless you went to law school, you might not understand them, or you might think they're really boring. So my job is to make them, like, simple and easy to understand and also sort of exciting, so that people care about this issue and we actually make some progress on it.
Well, that's great. Well, let's step back a minute, because I really think let's talk a little bit more, and I probably went over this too quickly. But, Marcus, what is the New Jersey Civil Justice Institute? If I had to explain it to someone, better yet, you explain it. So explain, what exactly is the institute?
So as I mentioned earlier, I like to say we're a chamber of commerce dedicated to one issue. So we have members ranging from large Fortune 100 companies to the New Jersey Chamber of Commerce, the New Jersey Business and Industry Association, the National Federation of Independent Business here in New Jersey, the doctors groups, the medical society, insurance companies, manufacturers, lots of different professional trades, the Bankers Association, Gas Station Retailers Association, the Apartment Association. So any business that has to exist and try to make money and employ people in our civil justice climate is interested in this issue. And in the past, the Chamber and BIA have done a very good job raising these issues. But I think there was a consensus among a lot of leading employers in New Jersey that there needed to be a voice on this issue consistently. It's an important issue to employers. It makes up enormous parts of their the cost of their doing business. And, you know, employers, like anybody else, are perfectly happy to play by the rules. But when they see a system tilt into an unfair direction where they think they're getting litigation that isn't deserved and it's costing increasing amounts of money when they haven't been doing anything wrong and even been caught doing anything wrong, they begin to get concerned. And so they wanted to create an organization that advocates for this change constantly. And so what we do is we lobby the legislature. We talk to the legislature about reforms we think would help fix the system, and we can go into a little bit of detail about that. We also analyze legislation when it's proposed to see if it creates undue liability for businesses in any reason. A good example of that is the paid sick leave legislation that's working its way through the legislature. There's enormous liability in that, and we're trying to persuade the legislature to enforce the paid sick leave mandate without lawsuits, but just with government oversight.
Okay, explain. That really is a good example, because I think a lot of people, I think a lot of businesses are concerned about, you know, paid sick leave only. Well, explain it a little bit, because I think that people have a misconception about what that proposed statute is. So that might be a good thing to, you know, just focus on for a bit, and then what types of lobbying would you do? Because I know you're trying to make it a better bill.
Yeah, so when you talk about paid sick leave, most people think you either have it or you don't, or the government's going to mandate it or they're not. And obviously legislation in this case in particular is much more complicated than that. So the state wants to mandate that employers have to provide 7 paid days of sick leave for certain employees every year, and it applies to employers, I think, of 15 people or more, if I remember correctly. And so that's a mandate that a lot of businesses are concerned about. But they could probably live with that simple mandate, either provide the paid sick leave or don't, and if you don't, maybe the government finds you or comes in or does something like that. The problem we see with this legislation is it creates a mechanism for individual employees to enforce the law by suing their employer. And it's a very wide, mushy, kind of hard for the court to get its hands around language. So, for example, the draft legislation creates a presumption of retaliation by an employer if they do anything to an employee who exercises their paid sick leave right under this bill. So if I own a fast food restaurant, or better yet, if I own a restaurant and I have a wait staff, and every Saturday night my waiter calls out sick using their paid sick leave, which they'd be entitled to do under this bill, but they do it every Saturday, and I choose to move them off the Saturday shift because that's my busy night and put them on Monday because I need a reliable employee on Saturday, they can sue me for that I've presumably retaliated against them for using their paid sick leave. Now, the facts will get hashed out in court as to whether it was truly retaliatory or not, but the presumption is on the employer to say, no, it wasn't retaliatory, it was because there was some other reason. At that point, you've paid for lawyers, the employer's paid for lawyers, the employee has hired a lawyer, and you're making a very litigious case out of something that really is simple. Did you provide paid sick leave or not?
And let me just interject just a moment, because what those of us who work in the court system, meaning those of us who are attorneys who appear in the court system, know is that our judges are just totally overwhelmed.
Right.
Now, people who know me know that my practice is limited to family law, but it's not just the matrimonial bench and bar. It's across the board.
Right.
And so that, you know, these lawsuits are, you know, just clog up the courts. So I agree with you that that's an interesting, and I think what people would be more concerned about, obviously, the idea of the paid sick leave is that, you know, the mom can take off when, you know, she's sick, or I believe the legislation also covers children, that if mm-hmm. a child is sick, that a parent can take off. And, you know, that's a great idea, but you're right, unless it is dealt with in the right way, it shouldn't be a way for more litigation. And I guess the other issue would be what happens if the waiter or waitress who calls in every Saturday night is just a very poor performer. Could that then also end up in retaliation? Because it would be very easy to say, well, I called in sick a couple times, and as a result, I was fired.
That's right. That's right. And so we don't take a position on the merits of paid sick leave as it stands. The business community, other business organizations do that. It's the enforcement mechanism. And as I said earlier about class actions, lawsuits aren't inherently bad. There's a role for suing each other when somebody's been negligent or harmed you. But lawsuit as an enforcement mechanism against employers really can get very complicated for employers and bog down the court system unnecessarily. And the language in this bill, as I said, is so wishy-washy on the very strong presumption that the employer has done something wrong if the employee alleges it, and how you kind of defend against that, that it really is a nightmare for employers. And so that's a good example of why we're trying to tell the legislature, look, you want to do paid sick leave, we don't have a dog in that fight, but let's enforce it in a common sense way that doesn't clog up our courts.
Now, I'm almost surprised that you wouldn't also be questioning the small employers, and one of the issues, of course, is at what number of employees should someone be exempt from this? And perhaps tell our audience a little bit more about why it would be important for the employer who didn't have, you know, one or two or three employees to also be under this new legislation.
Well, I think the legislature generally, when they're regulating business, takes a view that small employers don't have compliance staffs, they don't have an attorney on staff, they may not even have a human resources professional. And so the cost and time involved with complying with government regulation is much higher and much more difficult for those small employers. And so they usually try to exempt them at some level. Sometimes it's 5, sometimes it's 10, sometimes it's 15. It's arbitrary. There's no doubt about it. But I think it comes from a general understanding that your Flemington Car and Truck Company has a pretty robust human resources effort, and they can get, you know, they can comply, and it's not too difficult for them to comply. But your small business owner who owns a restaurant with 5 or 6 employees doesn't have the time and the ability to do that.
Well, also, may honestly, if they have 1 or 2 or 3 employees, may honestly not be able to afford to give that kind of sick leave. And is there any concern about the fact that, you know, 7 additional days could be a real burden financially on some small employers?
I think many legislators have those concerns, but too many don't, in my opinion. I mean, look at a lot of employees who lack established leave policies are seasonal workers. I mean, when you look at the largest employers in our state, they have paid sick leave policies. People who work for our largest employers, who work for large car dealerships, who work for pharmaceutical companies, insurance companies, they have leave. It's usually shift workers, seasonal workers, and the like. And those businesses are often have the tightest margins, and they often have employees who come work for them for 2 or 3 months and leave. I know one of the biggest industries of concern here is the shore. A lot of the shore businesses that are really only open from Memorial Day to Labor Day, having to give 7 days if they were included in this legislation would be just onerous to them, and they've been fighting it quite a bit.
And, of course, and Emily might join me in this since she's originally from Missouri and I'm originally from Wisconsin. What was amazing to me is that people would actually use sick days when they weren't sick. I mean, growing up in the Midwest, I mean, you did not call in sick. You did not stay out of school unless you truly were sick. And I know that my own husband, who was a professor at the College of New Jersey, when he retired, he had something like 1,600 hours of sick leave that he didn't get paid for. And I think anybody, probably including me, thought, you know, why didn't you take, and he could legitimately have taken some of that due to some medical conditions. But that's one thing that I've heard over and over and over again, not only state employees, but other employees. I mean, if they just tack on their sick days to their vacation days so that, you know, they know how many days a year that they can take off. But I guess the sick leave, nobody has to, in the bill, my understanding is nobody really has to prove they're sick. They don't have to get a note from the doctor. They can just call in sick.
Right.
And is there any, you know, anything at all that the employer can do if it's that last minute call when somebody is really crucial?
I mean, I think that's, you're getting kind of the heart of the issue is you're, the state in this instance is kind of stepping into the traditional human relationship where an employer gets to hold an employee accountable to their leave, but the employee gets leave. And I think that's where it gets very difficult to regulate in this area. And just for our issue, doing it through lawsuits makes it even more onerous to businesses.
And New Jersey would be the only state where this is enforced via lawsuit. There's no other state that's decided to enforce paid sick leave via litigation.
Well, then, Emily, tell me a little bit, what are some of the other states doing if they're enacting legislation? How is it differing in this case? How would it differ from the New Jersey statute?
Well, in New York City, they thought about doing the litigation enforcement, and they decided it's too onerous, so they just cut that part out. So now you just report it to the government officials, and they do the enforcement.
How? Do you know? I mean, I guess what would be, either one of you, what would be the better mechanism? Let's assume that a statute is passed and there is a mandatory sick leave. What's the best way to deal with abuses?
Fines. I mean, you think about what government does to individuals typically in small violation situations. Parking tickets, traffic violations, you get a fine. You don't get locked in prison. You don't get sued. You don't get hauled into court. I think the same applies to these types of things. It's a very, you know, the vast majority of businesses bend over backwards and expend a lot of resources to comply with government mandates. They want to do what the government tells them to do. They want to do right by their employees. And so simply allowing an employee to report their employer to the Department of Labor and get a fine of some amount, $1,000, $5,000 per instance, and more if they do it repeatedly, is a very simple way to do it. It forces the business to comply. It gives the employee the ability to enforce that by reporting them to a state agency. But litigation not only is wasteful to the court system, time-consuming, but exponentially more expensive because lawyers are expensive.
Well, now, how would you suggest that this be set up in the Department of Labor? In other words, there would have to be a mechanism for an employee who complains. And what would that mechanism be as compared to what this statute seems to be headed towards?
I mean, there are scores of government programs at the Department of Labor, Department of Environmental Protection, any regulatory agency that set up a system of fines and voluntary reporting by, you know, employees or neighbors or whoever else. You can go to the government and point out that somebody's not complying with the law, and the government will investigate and levy whatever statutory penalty there is. Our point is that in the grand scheme of things, liability, being able to sue somebody privately and recover privately to enforce public law, is a very slippery slope. And Emily's right to point out that New Jersey is the only state that would be the only state to have liability enforcing a paid sick leave law, distinct from California, New York City, many other places. But it's a trend, a disturbing trend we see in a lot of New Jersey legislation, where let's make businesses do X and let's let people sue them in private civil court to enforce the law. I think the preferable model is for the government to be on the hook to enforce the mandates they impose on business. It's quicker, it's more effective, and it doesn't create the incentive with attorney's fees and fee shifting for private people to play gotcha on employers for their own financial benefit. So one of the larger issues we see in the civil justice system is the United States operates under the American law, where you can you pay your own attorney's fees unless the statute says otherwise. And we see a massive proliferation of fee-shifting statutes in New Jersey only in the direction of the plaintiff, never in the direction of the defendant if they're successful, that incentivize attorneys to bring these cases. And look, attorneys have a right to make money, but when the legislature does that, they're creating industries of attorneys who make their living using those statutes to make money.
And filing what some of us are concerned about, that are frivolous suits. I mean, it does seem when you talk about the coupons, for example, or you talk about some of these others, I mean, you know, people kind of laughed at that Subway suit where the, you know, the bun was 11 and a half inches rather than 12. But I think you're right. What people don't realize is the cost of that kind of litigation, and there are plaintiff's attorneys out there who will take those cases, because one of the things that most of us who've ever been involved in the law realize that, for example, insurance companies don't want to defend against certain cases. And I know if you talk to doctors, for example, they realize that, you know, if they're sued, the insurance company will most likely want to settle because they don't want to pay the legal fees and risk anything. Same thing with legal malpractice. I mean, you know, you can file any kind of a frivolous suit. So those of us who are attorneys, those of us who are doctors and certain other professions see this. And I'm sure that it also can happen with businesses. But this is a concern, and it does clog up the courts.
Right.
I mean, there's no question that these suits clog up the courts. Well, we're going to take a brief break for news, and then we'll be back with more from our guests today. I'm learning a lot, so we'll be right back.
USA Radio News with Melody Burkett.
That if you're rich and powerful, if you're poor and unemployed, you will be treated equally under the law.
That's Bernie Sanders speaking to a crowd in Nevada. He says a fair criminal justice system should be a core principle of the U.S. Polls indicate the race between Hillary Clinton and Sanders is tight in Nevada. Ahead of Nevada's Democratic caucuses, Sanders also called for a boost in the minimum wage at a rally today.
That a $7.25 minimum wage is a starvation wage. Got to be raised to a living wage, $15 an hour over the next few years.
Sanders also argues that faith must be restored in a broken criminal justice system. He says people who are arrested for possession of marijuana could face many years in prison, while those responsible for the 2008 financial meltdown remain free. This is USA Radio News.
I'm a pair of designer shoes so expensive, my owner had to give up half-decaf skim vanilla lattes just to afford me. So you can imagine my terror when a pipe burst and the apartment started flooding. There I was, trapped in the closet, water rushing all around me. But what was I to do? I'm a 6-inch stiletto. It's not like I can run.
Your stuff can't protect itself. That's why the Geico Insurance Agency helps make it easy to switch and save on renter's insurance.
At Crown Trophy of Flemington, we have thousands of products for you to choose from. Whether you're looking for trophies, plaques, or corporate awards, Crown Trophy of Flemington is your one-stop shop. We feature acrylic and crystal awards and promotional products for any occasion. We build and engrave all awards right on site. And we're a leading supplier of varsity jackets for local sports teams. We provide quality customer service and great pricing. Crown Trophy of Flemington is conveniently located in the Staples Shopping Center in Flemington. Crown Trophy of Flemington, we're trophies and a whole lot more.
Don't fear technology. Use it, understand it, and embrace it. The mission of Tech Today is to demystify technology. I'm your host, Chris Bianco, principal of Blue Panther Business Partners. Every Tuesday morning from 10 to 11, we will cover new apps, buying advice, technology news, and answer your questions. Good day, and join me on Tech Today on HuntertonChamberRadio.com.
This is Jeannie Aversa, CRPC, financial advisor at Patton Hiding Associates. Do you have questions about your retirement, like will your money last throughout your lifetime? Will you have enough to live the life you want? And when will you be able to retire? If so, you're not alone. As a financial advisory practice of Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., Patton Hiding Associates can help you find the answers with the exclusive Confident Retirement Approach. We'll work with you one-to-one to understand your goals and discuss the four key areas of retirement, including covering your essentials, lifestyle, protection, and legacy needs. From there, we'll work together to develop a retirement roadmap with clear steps you can take to help you retire on your terms. Call Patton Hiding Associates today at 908-713-6600. Office is located at 1318 Route 31 North, Annandale, New Jersey. The Confident Retirement Approach is not a guarantee of future financial results. Investment advisory products and services are made available through Ameriprise Financial Services, Inc., a registered investment advisor.
Well, we're back. The program, It's the Law. I'm your host, Pat Smits, and my guests today are Marcus Rayner and Emily Kletchen. And they are with the New Jersey Civil Justice Institute. And we were talking earlier about some of the things that they're doing. But I think it would be interesting for me and I think our listeners to hear something about the reforms that you think could make the New Jersey system better. And perhaps keep more of our businesses in New Jersey. Because although you haven't mentioned it, that is certainly a concern among many people that we need to keep our tax base, and a big part of our tax base, of course, are our businesses here in New Jersey.
Yeah, it's an important issue, and let me throw out a few facts that I think your listeners will find interesting. We did a study in 2008 and 2012 on plaintiffs suing in mass torts as classes against pharmaceutical companies in New Jersey, which most of your listeners probably know. The pharmaceutical industry in New Jersey is one of the largest employing bases in the state and one of our largest economic drivers. 93% of the plaintiffs in class action lawsuits against our pharmaceutical companies in the state of New Jersey, in New Jersey courts, are out-of-state plaintiffs. 93% are out-of-state plaintiffs. So people are coming from out of New Jersey into our courts to sue our employers for product labeling disputes and the like, and that's a problem. We're going to talk a little bit about the Consumer Fraud Act, and New Jersey has seen Consumer Fraud Act lawsuits by private attorneys against employers go up over 500% in the last 10 years, and we are second only to California in the number of lawsuits against food companies in our state. And we have a number of food companies in the state of New Jersey. Mars Incorporated, Goya Foods, Reckitt Benckiser makes home products, and Unilever makes food products as well. So it's a major concern. And
let me just ask you, and I don't mean to interrupt, but since we're second only to California in food, what types of lawsuits have these been? You know, it's one thing if you open a can of something and find a, you know, snake in it, I guess. But
it's labeling. Know. It's labeling. And the Consumer Fraud Act, we talked a little bit earlier before the break about incentivizing litigation. And the Consumer Fraud Act is set up to originally to go after companies that commit fraud. But inherent in it or contained in it is an incentive for attorneys to act as private attorney generals, essentially to find violations and bring suit, and they recover their attorney's fees and treble damages for any loss to the consumer. Now, that sounds like a good thing, and in many cases it is, but it's created a whole industry of lawyers who go out and kind of play gotcha with companies. The Subway suit is a good example of that. Campbell's Soup will get sued over all natural on their label, even though their label complies with the Federal Food and Drug Administration requirements. But someone will say, well, what is all natural? It has some sort of chemical in it that isn't found in nature. And then a court has to decide if that's all natural or not. And in the meantime, a lot of money is expended. Our Consumer Fraud Act in New Jersey is an outlier. It's one of the only consumer fraud acts in the country that mandates treble damages. Many other states have multipliers, meaning the court can award damages, double damages, or three times damages. Our Consumer Fraud Act allows lawsuits from outside the state into New Jersey, so residents from outside New Jersey.
Let me ask you, and let me stop you there. Why? How do they get around the fact is it because the companies are here? Is that why they say the nexus is here in New Jersey?
Correct.
And what do other states do? Because let's say the company is here in New Jersey and the plaintiff is out in Missouri. I mean, what would other states do in those circumstances? Wouldn't they require the plaintiff to go to the state where the company is located?
Some do, some don't. A lot of states require that the transaction take place in the state or that the company be domiciled in the state. We've proposed and we advocate for the Consumer Fraud Act in New Jersey to either require that the transaction be in New Jersey or the plaintiff be in New Jersey. So if you're flying through Newark Airport and you live in Missouri and you buy something in New Jersey, you can use the New Jersey Consumer Fraud Act. If you live in Missouri and you buy a product from a company that's in New Jersey, you should use the Missouri Consumer Protection Statute because every state has one. New Jersey's Consumer Fraud Act should be for New Jersey residents and New Jersey transactions, essentially, we believe.
And why isn't it? I mean, what happened when this Consumer Act was put into why didn't that happen here in New Jersey?
Well, I think when the Consumer Fraud Act was originally enacted in 1960, only the Attorney General of the state of New Jersey could enforce it. Then in the early 1970s, the legislature expanded it to allow these private rights of action. And I think the thinking when they did it was pretty simple. It was, if I go to a business and they take my money fraudulently, I would like to recover my money as the consumer. And so it was to give the consumer the power of the law to go after that business, get their court costs and fees paid for, and get treble damages as a punitive measure to make the consumer whole and deter future fraud by the business. That's all good, and when it works properly, we actually don't have a problem with that. I don't think the legislature foresaw the army of attorneys that would turn this into an attorney full employment act. And so the courts are not well equipped to distinguish between the truly fraud bad actor and the Subway sandwich suit. I mean, when you're a judge and you have a class of millions of people who allege that the Subway sandwich suit is a half an inch too short sometimes, the court can't just throw that out, as we might like them to. They have to kind of consider it on the merits and on the facts, and it has to work its way through the system at a great cost. And as a matter of public policy, we would argue those are not the businesses we should be. We shouldn't be punishing Subway for bread that doesn't rise all the way. We should be punishing the fly-by-night contractor or the business that lies to its consumer about whether its product will work or not. And what we need, in our opinion, is a recalibration of the Consumer Fraud Act to encourage the system to go after fraud and the worst actors, not play gotcha with legitimate businesses.
Well, and I know you represent a lot of big businesses, but one of the concerns about the Consumer Fraud Act is also the small business, the small contractor, who, you know, perhaps doesn't make a change in the contract, or, you know, the guy who's going in and doing some construction and the wife says, well, you know, would you do this, and doesn't write it down. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that, because a lot of our listeners are small business people, and any examples of how someone can do a gotcha on one of the smaller businesses?
You just gave a great one. You clearly know what you're talking about. I mean, contractors are required under the law, when they submit an estimate to a homeowner, to put the start and end date on the contract in 10-point font or greater. if the start and end date slips because of weather or because the homeowner decides to use a different product and they don't resubmit an estimate with a new end date, they're technically guilty of a violation of the Consumer Fraud Act, and they can go after them. And we just had a group start in Mercer County of contractors who are actually getting shaken down. The stories they tell are amazing. They actually will do work for homeowners who then turn around and say, I'm not paying the bill, and if you sue me for breach of contract, I'm going to come after you under the Consumer Fraud Act because of insert technical violation. You can go on the Division of Consumer Affairs website in Trenton and look at the regulatory requirements for businesses under the Consumer Fraud Act, and it is a labyrinth of small rules and regulations that any business would have trouble complying with. And they're all well-intended, right? They're all for good ideas. You want businesses to print things so that elderly people with vision problems can read them. I get that.
Well, and you want to protect against the fly-by-night,
That's right.
I think the concern is it is, as you said, the gotcha against the really honest guy who, you know, goes in and does a great job, and then because of some technicality, as you said, you know, with this group in Mercer County, that they're not getting paid, and it, you know, and then they can't pay their suppliers, and you know, this is a real concern. There's no question about it.
It is, and it's one of our top priorities because, as I said, the Attorney General has limited resources and is going to make sure that he or she goes after businesses that are perpetrating real fraud. They're going to use the power of their office to find the business who really is just lying to people and pocketing their money for no benefit, and they're going to shut them down, and they should. But when you have this very, very powerful law with myriad labyrinthian provisions and you give the power of individual attorneys to get their fees paid for on a suit, the unintended consequence of that is this game of gotcha that really can hurt small business. It can destroy small businesses' business. And, you know, the scariest thing in the world I can imagine, second to a police officer arriving at my door with bad news, is being served with a lawsuit. Because the minute you're served with a lawsuit, if you're a business owner or an individual, the first thing you have to do is go pay for an attorney. And I don't know a lot of people who have $500 an hour, let alone $20,000 in multiple hours.
By the way, we don't all charge that much, guys.
No, right.
So don't get too worried. But the fact is, for a small business that's operating on a slim margin, especially with the economy and the, for example, I was using the construction trade because they've gone through a real tough time. Yeah. And so that it is, you're absolutely right. Of course, I don't think people like to get the divorce complaint served on them either,
well, that's true too.
Since I'm a divorce lawyer. But honestly, litigation, every litigation is so expensive. Right. I mean, for example, this morning, it was a pro bono case, but I spent 4 hours in court, and it turned out that the other attorney could not get there. Now, it really wasn't his fault. He was a jury. He was dealing with a jury and down in Ocean County. But the fact is, I had to spend 4 hours there, and you know that was a tremendous amount of either if my client was paying, it would have been a lot of money. Or, you know, meanwhile, I had to keep my office open. I had to pay my staff. I had to do all these other things. So litigation is really expensive. I mean, there's just no question about it.
And this is why we think these changes to the Consumer Fraud Act are so important. I mean, the courts have to follow the law. And the, as I said, the courts under this mandatory treble damage scheme have very little resource to kind of separate the wheat from the chaff and scale penalties to the crime. And so if you're a contractor who does a $10,000 job for a homeowner and all of a sudden find yourself on the receiving end of a Consumer Fraud Act suit, that $10,000 becomes $30,000 because of treble damages, plus you have to go hire an attorney, plus if the plaintiff is successful, you have to pay the plaintiff's attorney's fees, so double attorney's bills, treble the value of the job. We think the court should have the discretion to say, look, the homeowner was happy. The kitchen was built. It was built with the specifications put forward in the estimate. But maybe the start and end date didn't get put on the form, or maybe it was a month late. So maybe you give the court can give the homeowner some money back rather than throwing treble damages. The court currently doesn't have that discretion, and we think judges should have that discretion.
Well, I think something else that's important to point out is that from a contractor's perspective, it's not just the cost of the suit, but being branded someone that's fraudulent. And that's a very emotional thing. Like if you're fulfilling your obligations, but someone's saying you committed fraud because you have the wrong size font on your paperwork, you're going to want to just, you know, settle the case and keep it quiet because you don't want word to get out that you're a fraudster, you know? So we actually have a hard time hearing about these cases because so many of them get settled and because people don't want to talk about being branded a fraudster and they don't want to publicly say, you know, I got sued for fraud, when really, you know, maybe it's not fraud in the traditional sense.
Well, and you've brought up a good point, Emily, and that is that a lot of lawsuits get settled only because it costs too much to go to trial. You will hear doctors who complain because they really didn't commit malpractice. This is an area that I'm pretty familiar with. They didn't commit malpractice, but their insurance company doesn't want to go to court. They don't want to have their name on the front page of the paper. So, in fact, they settle these cases. And I know we've had some problems in New Jersey that there are many doctors who will no longer deliver babies because they're just, you know, they're just so at risk, even though, you know, they did nothing wrong. And the fact is not every baby is going to be born without problems. But so you're doing this not from the malpractice standpoint, but from the same type of thing from what I'm hearing.
Well, we do represent the doctors on these issues too. And you're right, doctors are in a particularly hard spot because they often have to follow their insurance company's lead for their medical malpractice suits. And even if the doctor feels that they did nothing wrong, didn't commit malpractice, their insurance company may settle the case because the cost of trial is so expensive that it's cheaper just to write a check and make it go away. And that's a problem that exists for your small contractor and your Fortune 100 company. I mean, you talk to good litigators on both sides, and they will tell you that if I know the facts of a case, I can within 5 minutes tell you what its real value is. And they start with the idea that there's either value to the case or there isn't. And if there is, often even the big companies will settle rather than have to go through the cost of discovery and litigation and all of that. It's extremely expensive. And the more complicated the case, the more expensive it is. And so, you know, we talk about frivolous lawsuits, and frivolous is a little bit in the eye of the beholder, but because what I think is frivolous, you may not. But at the end of the day, if you're hit with a lawsuit and you can survive summary judgment, which is the first thing the court decides, is if you do you have a case, basically, there's an enormous incentive to settle, whether you've done anything wrong or not.
There is. I mean, I think all of us as attorneys know this, and, you know, I even have to tell my clients that sometimes it's certainly better to pay your spouse more or take less than to pay me. And that is certainly one of the concerns. Well, let's see. What are the other couple other examples of the types of things that you're doing? And can anyone join, become a member of the Institute? I guess I should ask that.
Yes, anyone can. We have individual members, defense attorneys, and small business members. You can go to our website, which is www.civiljusticenj.org. And Emily will repeat that a couple of times because she's in charge of the website. She does a great job. But we have a free newsletter that goes out every Friday. You don't even have to be a member to sign up for that. So you can do that if you're interested in these issues.
Why don't you give us the website again?
Yeah, it's civiljusticenj.org. And the newsletter sign-up is actually right on the homepage. And if you've been touched by our talking about the Consumer Fraud Act, we've actually got a petition asking the legislature for some reform right on the homepage as well. So if you are very passionate about this and want to join our fight to improve the Consumer Fraud Act in New Jersey, you can find that on our homepage and sign up for that too.
And really, if you're a business that does business with consumers, whether you sell cars, you do home improvements, or you even do a retail, you should become aware of the Consumer Fraud Act. And I would encourage you to look at our website, but also go to the Division of Consumer Affairs, because it is a very broad and large and aggressive piece of legislation or statute that businesses need to be aware of.
Well, you're absolutely right, and I represent a lot of small businessmen. As everybody knows, I do divorce, premarital agreements, etc. But because I have so many clients who are, in fact, business people, it's amazing to me two things in New Jersey. One, that most small businesses, especially the contractors, you know, the plumbers, the electricians, and some of the small, they've heard about it, but they think they can just have some form contract and that will work. And the other thing that always amazes me is how few people in New Jersey have wills, but that's another That's another issue. I guess they think here if you don't do any estate planning, you won't die. Right. But I think that What can a small business, what should someone who's interested in starting a business or, you know, kind of does it part-time and then wants to go into it full-time? These are the people I find that just are not getting the information that they need.
They're not. And you assume when you do something like that that the personal relationship will trump everything. That when you work, for example, use the contractor example again, you're in somebody's kitchen and you're doing work on their kitchen and you talk to them every day and you're doing your best to give them the product they want, you figure any disagreement or dispute is going to be held on an interpersonal basis. And that's not always true. And so you really need to be familiar with your exposure under the law and find out what your obligations are as a contractor so that you can avoid that. There are people out there that are litigious, and they're going to find a reason to skip out on the bill by suing you. On the flip side of that coin, there are businesses that are fraudulent, and there should be legal protections for consumers, and we believe that. The middle ground is where it gets a little dicey, where you have incentives to litigate where you don't need to that we're concerned about.
Well, I have one more question, and that is, are you finding that the attorneys that are filing some of these class action suits in New Jersey, are these New Jersey attorneys, or are they outside firms that maybe have one attorney in New Jersey because they need a New Jersey attorney to bring the suit?
The smaller suits are New Jersey attorneys. The big class actions can come from anywhere, and they will try to bootstrap in the New Jersey Consumer Fraud Act if they can because it's more powerful than most other state consumer fraud acts.
And so what would they need to get into New Jersey? Very little from what you're saying. They
really
don't have to do. Nobody has to be a resident here.
Well, most of the time, they do find a New Jersey person to add as a plaintiff.
But maybe one out of
hundreds,
unlimited. And certainly, if you're a New Jersey company, you're domiciled here, and we wouldn't even change that really.
Right.
But you can find one New Jersey person, two from Texas, two from California. Say that there's a million similarly situated, and file a lawsuit in New Jersey.
And what happens when that type of class action is well, they have to, first of all, they have to get it certified as a class.
Mm-hmm.
How difficult is that in New Jersey? Do you know?
Well, there's a recent appellate court decision, Daniels v. Hollister, where mm-hmm. the court basically made clear that they believe they should err on the side of certifying classes generously. We think that's problematic. We think the court should be very cautious in certifying these classes, because the truth of the matter is, again, there's two sides of this coin. If you're a plaintiff with a very small claim, something under $100, and you can't get the class certified, your claim probably goes away. And so in those situations, if all the plaintiffs are similarly harmed and similarly situated and have a similar relationship to the defendant, maybe the class is appropriate. On the other hand, if you're a defendant and you get a class certified against you, the case becomes so expensive to try that class certification is effectively the end of the case. You're probably going to settle that, unless you are the largest company and you have the largest legal budget and you really think that the court made a mistake. You might fight it, but it's very expensive. And so that class certification is really the whole crux of the case. If the class isn't certified, the plaintiff's case goes away, and if it is certified, the defendant faces monumental pressure to settle that case.
Well, that's a good point. We're going to come back shortly. I don't know. I think you said you might have to leave, and Emily and I will talk. But I want to just bring a couple more spots from our sponsors.
Hi, I'm Joe Peters of Weikert Realtors. Buying or selling a property can be one of the most expensive undertakings you face in your lifetime. And selecting the right realtor to help you through this process can dramatically affect your success or your failure. I have personally helped hundreds of buyers and sellers through this process in achieving their dreams and goals in 100 in Somerset County areas over the past 10 years. I believe that this experience should be a smooth, seamless one for you and not a roller coaster ride. But the best judgment as to whether or not I deliver this to my customers is their reactions in their own words.
One of the things we liked about Joe was that he would return calls within minutes if he wasn't able to pick up.
You know, Joe guided us through the process of selling our home and made a complicated transaction appear seamless.
How do I accomplish this? By approaching every transaction from a business perspective. Initially, I try to fully understand your goals and dreams and make them my own.
Then I go out and take the mass amounts of data that we have and distill them down to a few understandable action points to be considered. Finally, I control the entire process through technologies to ensure that we're not going to hit any speed bumps along the way. The end result to you is a smooth, rewarding customer experience. Let me show you how to take my level of professional expertise and put it to work for you in achieving your real estate goals and dreams. I can be reached at 908-238-0118. Thanks for your time.
Hey, this is Big C of Good Morning Hunterdon on HuntingChamberRadio.com. Like what you hear on Hunting Chamber Radio? Now you can take it with you. Download our Hunting Chamber Radio app from iTunes and Google Play Store now. Get schedules, station information, listen live, or to the latest podcasts. Everything in the palm of your hand or in your car during your commute. Get the HuntingChamberRadio.com app today.
I'm Andy Ross. I'm a CPA with the accounting firm of Bedard Corky & Company, and I joined the Chamber to interact with new Chamber members and expand our mutual needs for business networking and giving back to the Hunterdon business community.
Hunterdon Chamber of Commerce, building business, one business at a time.
Well, we're back, and Marcus had to leave, so I'm putting Emily on the hot seat. What would you like to cover that I really haven't asked at this point? What would be the most important thing that you'd like, not the most important thing, but something that you think our listening audience should know about?
Well, I think this is just sort of an interesting story that ties into what we've been talking about. I'm a young attorney, so I'm still taking a lot of continuing education classes to keep my license fresh and learn new things. And I noticed one of the classes they had pretty recently was learn how to sue people under the Consumer Fraud Act. So they're actually training attorneys to do this because it's a good way to make money. And when I was in law school, this was back in Wisconsin, but I went to a career day thing. I was trying to figure out, you know, what do I want to do when I grow up? And one of the things they said was, you know, figure out something you can do where there's a lot of fee shifting. So-and-so downtown does that, and, you know, he drives a really nice Corvette. So it's just the perception that we're training attorneys to have this be a profit center and that you can make your career suing businesses for fun and money, you know. It's astounding to me. It's not what I went to law school to do.
What do you think you're making progress on as part of the New Jersey Civil Justice Institute? Is there anything you're making some progress now that you think in changing some of the views of legislators?
Yeah, I think we're having really good progress. We talked earlier about paid sick leave and how we're trying to get them to take out the liability aspects of that bill. There's lots of legislation that has liability in it. And a good example is last session they passed the so-called ban the box legislation where now when you're hiring new people, you can't ask on the application if they have a criminal record. That's the box that has been banned. And when that bill was introduced, it wasn't going to be enforced via litigation. So we talked to the bill's sponsors and supporters of the bill and convinced them that, you know, you can do this. It's a fine idea, but you don't need to have people file lawsuits over it. If someone has a problem, they can just report it to the state and that business is going to get in trouble. And we're seeing a lot of legislation like that where we're making the argument that, you know, this could be done just with fees. And I don't want to say it's like tattling on them to the state, but telling the state they're doing something wrong and having the state enforce it instead of litigation.
But is that really the problem? Because the state doesn't want to do any of this. In other words, they're underfunded. Most of the agencies, most of the departments, you know, can't do the kind of work they're doing. So it sounds to me a little bit like they're saying, well, it's not, we can pass the legislation and we don't have to fund it. And that's been a real concern in New Jersey for a long time.
Right. And when you draft something and have it enforced via litigation, the bill drafters say that it costs $0 to enforce because you're not going to have to add any more staff. The courts are going to take care of it. But those of us that go to court, you know, we know that the courts are overworked and that there is